Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the U.S. a competitive country? On an individual basis, sure. And our domestic businesses certainly compete fiercely with one another. Think Coke and Pepsi or Google and Yahoo. But my guest today says without a national strategy to encourage entire industries to go head-to-head with their competitors overseas, we could lose our standing as a dominant force in the global economy. Over the course of his career, Richard J. Elkus has been CEO or director at more than 15 high-tech companies. In 1970, he oversaw the team at the Ampex Corporation that debuted the world's first consumer-grade VCR. Today, Elkus worries that the U.S. technology industry manufactures almost none of the products that it invents, conditions that make it tough to evolve product designs or innovate the next big thing. His new book explains why through 10 principles of competition for a technological world. It's called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. Dick, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
What tells you that we have lost our competitive edge as a nation?
If you take a look at most of the products that you see around you, especially those that relate to electronics, be they VCRs or cell phones or radios or television sets, you'll find that most of them are manufactured, and a great many, including some that are totally designed outside the United States. It's very easy to look around and pretty much see for yourself. If you look at the iPhone, which I happen to have sitting in front of me, it says designed in California, but assembled in China. Well, the component parts are also manufactured in China. The software is still absolutely U.S. and excellent, but the basic concept that is made available to the world is now being manufactured elsewhere.
Well, there was this big wave of change in the 70s and 80s and 90s that said that really successful companies would be more vertical. They would specialize in something like designing products and let another company, perhaps overseas, that specialized in manufacturing do that. You see that, though, as sort of a short-term solution. Can you talk about that?
Sure. If you take a look at what it takes to actually invent and then commercialize a product, it's a combination of manufacturing, design, development, as well as the initial concept. None of this stuff comes out of the ether. It comes from an evolution of products and markets and technologies over time. So as long as you have that infrastructure available to you and the ability to go back and forth between the manufacturing aspects of it, the technological aspects of it, you kind of know where the world is going. Things happen that you don't expect, and all of a sudden you have new products, new markets, et cetera. But the fact of the matter is that if you begin to lose your manufacturing base, a lot of the creativity that you think you have is not so much in the actual design itself, but in the actual design for manufacture and the commercialization of the product. So my point is really simple. If you lose your manufacturing base, you finally lose your ability to innovate, and therefore your competitiveness.
And what tells you, Dick, that the designing and the manufacturing have to happen in close physical proximity? For example, if an engineer is designing something, he or she would certainly follow through and at least probably check out the place where it was made and keep up with the people who were in manufacturing, right?
The answer is yes, but if you're talking about true high-tech and dimensional characteristics, parameter specifications that are becoming extremely sophisticated. The interplay between the actual design and what you can physically do to manufacture the product becomes totally intertwined. So, for example, and I'm speaking now for myself, but if you look at the semiconductor industry, which powers just about every product and market on Earth, it's my feeling that it's becoming, in many cases, more difficult to manufacture the semiconductor than it is to design it in the first place. Certainly, there has to be a relationship between the two. This does not mean that all of the manufacturing for all of your products has to be located in proximity to all of your design efforts. But certainly, there has to be enough of a position so that you truly understand the nature of the business that you're in, the nature of the products that you're manufacturing, and by the way, what is possible on the part of your competition.
You write that market and product growth is evolutionary as opposed to revolutionary. What does that mean in terms of production control and what aspects you should control?
By production control, I'm not sure exactly what you mean.
Well, in other words, controlling manufacturing so that it is close by. How do you decide which elements you definitely want to produce domestically and which ones can go overseas?
Well, that's actually a very good question. In most companies that produce products, value-added products, there are certain aspects of what they do that are strategic to their particular product. If you have something that is, in fact, like that, for example, a memory device for a cell phone or a display that belongs in an automobile, and you find that losing control of that could cost you the value-added position of the proprietary position of your product in relationship to your competition, you can find yourself in with a bit of a problem. So the first thing you've got to do is to figure out how you ensure that you not only have control of the manufacturing, or at least enough of it so that you know what you're doing, but that it's close enough by that you can have the appropriate interplay between your engineers and the people who are, in fact, actually manufacturing the product. In addition to that, because of the cost, and we can get into this later on, the cost, which goes up exponentially as you advance down the technological roadmap, you can't build everything. So you're going to want to have strategic relationships with partners that are either in the United States or any other nation. To have that, you need to have something to bring to the table. That is, it's not just money that keeps you together as you advance the state of the art of your product. It's the fact that you bring one level of expertise and the partner brings something else, and it kind of advances together. If you get out of the business, those kinds of strategic relationships become more and more difficult. The last thing is that you want to be very careful that you don't so educate the individual company or country that is manufacturing your product that they can ultimately use the strategic nature of your business to come back at you and compete with you, only they are both the supplier and the competitor. That's a bad deal.
My guest is Richard J. Elkus. He has served as CEO and director of more than 15 high-tech companies. His new book is called Winner Take All: How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. Let's talk for a minute about education, because you believe very strongly that the products that are produced within a country drive the kind of education that that country provides to its citizens.
I certainly do. My feeling is that if you look at education, education enhances a system. It supports the nature of what it is you're trying to accomplish. It certainly provides the technological educational base that is the foundation upon which knowledge grows and, in fact, your ability to compete in any given area grows. But education tends to follow, it is my belief, what the leaders of the country decide is the mission of that country. So, for example, if you really don't feel that manufacturing is structurally important to the country, if you really don't feel that engineering or technological development in a particular area is important, and in fact those jobs and careers and investments are outsourced someplace else, at some point in time, the students going into the curriculum that would advance their position in that particular field, the students no longer wanted to pursue it. The professors are the same way. The schools overall, the administration, the same way, they follow where the market is. So if the market driver for education is in finance, you're going to get students that come out in finance. If, in fact, the reason you want to go into engineering is to support a financial career in analyzing for an investment bank or whatever, that's the kind of educational background that will finally be offered to the students because that's where the market is.
Let's go back for a minute and talk about your career a bit. You managed the team that brought the first consumer-grade VCR to the world. There were these extraordinary rave reviews. This was at Ampex. What's striking about that now is when we think back to the VCR, Ampex doesn't even come to mind. We think Sony. We think Panasonic. How did that happen?
Well, it, in many respects, it's a remarkable story. In 1956... a group of, I think, five engineers headed up by Charlie Ginsberg and, interestingly enough, a gentleman by the name of Ray Dolby, who I think most people know as Dolby Sound, invented video recording, practical video recording. This was really the beginning of the information age. It was the first time that you could encapsulate, capture audiovisual material, store it on tape, play it back when you want it, edit it, use it however you want. And nothing like that had ever really happened before in any practical sense. This one little company in Redwood City, California, basically got all the patents in that particular field. And for a long time, nearly monopolized the industry. In 1970, we introduced a product which we called the home video recorder. It became the VCR, the video cassette recorder. And we did it with based upon all the patents and intellectual property that this little company had developed many years before. The one interesting aspect of this story is that in the same year, 1956, that Ampex invented video recording, right down the street, a gentleman from Bell Laboratories, William Shockley, was starting Shockley Transistor. And when I say down the street, within 2 miles of the front door of Ampex, which was the beginning of the semiconductor industry, which became fundamental to video recording as years passed. When we introduced the VCR, it really did have rave reviews. At that time, there was no such thing as pre-recorded tape, but the concept of having your own little recorder that could record and play something back and then re-record and whatever, it was just fascinating. Everybody wanted to have a piece of it. There was one nation that understood strategically the essence of where that could take them, and that was Japan. Because Ampex, at that moment in time, had no financial capability to truly commercialize this product and no real understanding of the consumer electronics field, especially manufacturing, which, interestingly enough, it had already outsourced in those areas involving audio recording, it looked for a partner. The most obvious partner to the top management of Ampex then was a company in Japan called Toshiba. At the time, I wanted to do something personally with Motorola, who offered Quasar television sets and whatever and understood the consumer electronics market very well.
And Motorola is a U.S. company.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everybody knows the name Motorola. In fact, if you look at it today, in a way, it's a bit of a tragedy because much of the company as we used to know it is getting broken up. But in any case, I was told that the company we should deal with that would have less competitive concerns for Ampex later on was this company, Toshiba, in Japan. Less concerned about competitive aspects because at that time, most people looked at Japan as somebody who was very interested in manufacturing a product, would provide whatever you wanted at a very low cost, would put up the money necessary for manufacturing and technological investment to manufacture so that it reduced the amount of cash you had to put up and increased your profits and margins with no real position in the end-use product product area. It was the safe bet. So I went over and made a deal with the then chairman of Toshiba, a gentleman by the name of Toshio Doko. When I was finished with those negotiations, looking at the gentleman I was negotiating with, who was not only chairman of Toshiba, but he was also chairman of an organization called Keidan Ren, which is the strategic side for the private sector of Japan, cooperating with the public sector as they try to figure out a national strategy for where the country should be going. I was almost certain that Toshiba got what they wanted, that is a product that was potentially strategic for the nation. I wasn't sure, even though we agreed on all the points that we were looking for, that we, that is Ampex, and certainly the United States got what we wanted. The other aspect of that.
Let me have you stop right there because we're going to take a break.
Sorry.
Richard J. Elkis is our guest. His new book is called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. We'll talk more about what happened with the invention of the VCR and how that helped springboard Japan's technology industry after this break. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Richard J. Elkus. He has been CEO or director of more than 15 high-tech companies throughout his career. His new book is called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Dick, before the break, you were talking about the deal that Ampex made with Toshiba to produce these VCRs. And what's very interesting about what you were discussing is that this was viewed not only as a strategic move for the Toshiba company, but for the nation of Japan as a whole.
That's exactly right. And let me give you some little incidents that occurred after that that really demonstrates everything and really talks to the point of competitiveness of nations, whatever nation you're talking about. At the time that we made the deal with Toshiba, the total number of video recorders sold in the world were 14,000 units. By 20 years later, in Japan, the total number of video recorders sold in the world were 50 million units. Now, if you look at a video recorder, it included a tape deck that used a cassette, which we now know encloses a pre-recorded medium for movies and whatever else, and a camera, electronic camera, and then a television set to see whatever it is that you recorded. If you think about that, there's one word that covers just about everything that relates to competitiveness and why strategy is so important, and it's called convergence. Over time, technologies tend to converge. Products and markets influence each other, become reinforcing aspects to the next product and the next product, etc. So I'll give you an example. If you take the video recorder, when we first introduced it with the 16-pound recorder and then this few-ounce tape cassette that's the size that weighs as much as a cell phone today but much larger in size, and then an electronic camera that weighed 5-6 pounds, and then a television set, whatever size you wanted, you're talking about a relatively large and not easily maneuverable set of circumstances. Well, as time went on, because of the volume that the VCR represented in terms of numbers of units sold, and because it became, there were no PCs then, personal computers, the largest single user of semiconductor devices of any product on Earth, that little company down the street from Ampex, Shockley Transistor, which was the foundation then for Silicon Valley and the semiconductor companies and the industry that grew therefrom in the United States of America, it literally sucked out a major portion of the U.S. semiconductor market and brought it to Japan because it became part and parcel of the VCR. It did the same thing to the display industry, television industry, to the point where the United States no longer manufactures any television sets or virtually any television sets. It took out much of the robotics industry, the materials industry, the electronic cameras. It caused Kodak unbelievable problems and finally finished the U.S. when it came to electronic cameras in the United States. So here this little product called a VCR, not so little then, over time began to cause a convergence of all kinds of technologies in different industries. Now, another thing occurred as each one of those individual industries began to evolve. The memories in semiconductors became far more powerful, and the processors, the displays became far more powerful. You were able to take electronic cameras and put it into a single device and stick it in the back of a cell phone. And the next thing you know, yes, something like my iPhone that's sitting on my desk here, and that iPhone, for all practical purposes, includes everything that was in that VCR. It includes the display, it includes the memory, the processor, the camera. It does one other thing. It can communicate this information in whatever form you want anywhere in the world, for that matter in outer space. So it's a remarkable device. Each one of the component parts represents an industry in and of itself. In most of those component areas today, you don't see a major position of the United States anymore. And if you look at the number of units that are being sold in cell phones and recognize that it went from 14,000 VCRs or 14,000 video recorders in 1970 to 50 million at the end of the 80s, you're now talking in excess of a billion units, growing at 10 to 20% a year. And the largest market today is no longer in the United States, it's in China, and certainly all of Asia.
And so while many people think that Asia's fundamental strength today is about cheap labor, you think it's actually about the ability to produce things of technological excellence?
The answer is I not only think it, I know it. Cheap labor in the long run for high technology is not where it's at. Where it's at is in the investment, which becomes huge. The investment in plant, equipment, technological expertise to manufacture and commercialize the product. This is the reason why the VCR and electronics was so important then to Japan. Here was a nation that included about 130 million people with a land mass that is less than the state of California, only 20% of which is habitable, no natural resources, that at the end of World War II was flat on its back. It wasn't concerned about how much money it could make for individuals or companies. It was concerned about how it was going to feed its country. And what they wanted was an industrial base that was highly scalable, that is, that had massive capability to serve the markets of the world from this little island sitting in the Pacific. And the video recorder and then the products that came therefrom were perfect for that. If you look at Japan today and recognize that from a natural resource base, it has basically nothing, and you look at the labor rates, which, when you include the overhead, are equal or greater to that paid in the United States, and recognize that its greatest single customer is China today, no longer the United States, and in fact, it's maintained an export position in the world, literally from the time that it got involved in the electronics industry on till today, you recognize very quickly that it is not cheap labor that gets you there at all.
And Japan now has had other countries following its model, South Korea, most notably, much more recently. And it's sort of doing the same thing.
Well, and Taiwan, and believe me, China is right behind.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Richard J. Elkus. His new book is called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. Let's speak to Dave in Fort Worth. Hi, Dave.
Yes. I'm trying to pinpoint the fact that we, as a nation of everybody in the world, have been more innovative than everybody else, period. Since 1900, we as a nation have done more in creating, and everybody else will take a knockoff if they want, but we're the ones who actually come up with the idea, then everybody else runs with it. Yes, the Chinese developed black powder and such like that, but I can't see any relevancy to that. My father was an engineer at General Dynamics forever, and everything that they did, the rest of the world wanted.
Well, that's a very interesting point, Dave. And I know that one of the things that you've written about, Dick, is the fact that we've actually given willingly a lot of technology, which has been as much of a threat to us as having knockoffs being produced.
Right. First of all, the logic of what was just presented was exactly what I was told by the CEO of Ampex when I went to make a deal with Toshiba. That is, they're great at rote memorization, repeating our own developments, but not necessarily any good at creativity and the imagination required to come up with products of their own. It's been my experience that that is absolutely not the case. And let me give you a specific. In 1988, I made a comment at a talk I gave when I was discussing the field of high-definition television, which I think most people know something about. And I said that, you know, the time is going to come when the VCR, as we know it, is going to become a component. And you're going to be able to plug that component into any computer or whatever other device and effectively transfer the capabilities of the VCR to wherever, which is exactly what's happened to the cell phone. When I said that, I had no knowledge of the fact that 1 year later, Toshiba, the same company that I made the deal with back in 1970, announced a product called NAND Flash, which is a memory device which allows you to effectively replicate all of the characteristics of a video recorder. You can record sight and sound either in still frame or in full motion. and effectively use that as a plug-in device to enable various products, such as a cell phone, to do everything that the VCR did. That was introduced by Toshiba. They are now in the top two producers of that product in the world. And the level of creativity in terms of the products and markets that came out of that are just overwhelming.
We have an email from Keith in Garland who asks, is it possible for American businesses or the U.S. government to regain the technology and manufacturing base from Japan and China, and is it a priority?
I think that there is no choice. By the way, I've often heard, you know, it's over, the game is over. I don't believe the game is over. I don't think that we can allow it to be over because it's going to mean such a degradation in the standard of living, let alone political security of this nation, and maybe the world that depends upon us, that nobody in the long run will stand for it. The question is what kind of pain you have to go through to finally turn it around. My feeling is that it is absolutely essential that in strategic areas such as displays or semiconductors, or for that matter, consumer electronics, that the United States have a position. And the reason I say that is that because those particular areas of activity really involve virtually every other product or market on Earth. If you think of those products as basically encapsulating and advancing the ability to handle and process information, that is viable. That's valuable to agriculture or textiles or aircraft or automobiles. So the answer is we got to be there. There are a lot of ways to do it. None of them are easy.
Would you want to see the same kinds of government incentives and bailouts, I guess, that exist in order to keep the agriculture industry in this country?
You mean the agriculture industry?
In other words, there are subsidies.
You mean to do the same thing for electronics as we do for agriculture?
Yeah, subsidies for, you know, farming and things like that.
Well, I'm not really an expert on the agricultural industry. There are a lot of countries in the world, including Japan, that very much value the production of food. A lot of it stems from the fact that if you can't produce what your people eat, you can become unbelievably dependent upon somebody else. That's exactly what I don't want to see happen in the areas of technology, which then affect your ability to produce your own food. My feeling is that you don't look at this as a bailout. The cost of being in technology is so great, and I can give you an example of that very quickly, but just for the second, the cost is so great that bailouts from the U.S. government just don't work. There's just not enough money. You have to dedicate the country as a whole to wanting to be in these businesses and then over time make the investments or attract people outside of the United States to make investments in the United States, as we have done in Japan and elsewhere, to reinstitute the business and the technology back in the country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Dick Elkus is my guest. His book is called Winner Take All. Let's go next to John in Denton. Hi, John.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
That book sounds wonderful, and I will buy it. I think that really most Americans ought to think about buying it as well.
Boy, I think you are really right.
I'm 73 years old. I spent a good portion of my life working for the automotive industry and the industrial side, a company by the name of Allison and Detroit Diesel. Spent the last few years market research. Anyway, we have become the water boy for the rest of the world. That's it, bottom line. And the issue, of course, is that we've lost our textile industry. We lost our precision machining industry. We've lost most of our die casting and plastic injection molding industries. We've lost nearly every industry that made a product. And we've done this to ourselves only for the benefit of the profits of a few. Maybe the stockholders have benefited, but on the other hand, at the same time they benefited, whether they realize it or not, they're losing their nation. And I don't know how this can be turned around, but I know one thing. We're going in the wrong direction. We have been for about 35 years. Edward Stemming, who took the miracle to Japan, the American industry basically turned him down, but he took the ideas and the concepts to Japan that basically turned around their society. I met him once back in the 80s, and he had the idea that we really could do it here. But really, nobody is listening. But I congratulate you for this book. I just hope the heck somebody's listening.
John, thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome.
I have a couple of comments to make there.
Sure.
First of all, I really, really appreciate his comments. I agree with everything that he says. I wrote an article in 1991 for Automobile Magazine. And I think I entitled it, it's in the book, I just don't remember exactly. I think it was called The Seamless Product. And what I was talking about was the fact that at that moment in time, there was a company called Matsushita, which a lot of people know as Panasonic. And they advertised in Fortune magazine all of the various products that they manufactured, including displays and GPS systems that they were about to announce and cameras and other things, all of which could be integrated into an automobile. Now, there was more than Matsushita sitting there. There was Sony and Fujitsu and NEC and on and on. And all of these companies were working in conjunction with their automobile manufacturers, for example, Toyota. And I could see the time coming when, in fact, when you looked at a Toyota, which became the concept became what we now know as Lexus, a totally integrated product where literally you couldn't tell the beginning from the middle from the end. All of these individual things would be hooked together, work as a complete unit. The engine would only be one aspect of the car. The electronic systems, the control of the air, the driving, the safety, the comfort, the communication, all of that would become equally, if not more, important. And all of it would be so integrated that if you didn't have the ability in the United States, and I thought we were losing it, very, very quickly, you'd not be able to be competitive. And I predicted that in the next few years, if that finally came to pass, which it did, that the automobile industry would be in terrible trouble, which it is.
Richard J. Elkus is my guest. His new book is called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. We'll take more of your calls after the break. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. If you want to contact us via email, that address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Richard J. Elkus. His book is called Winner Take All, How Competitiveness Shapes the Fate of Nations. Dick, you mentioned earlier that the cost of putting in new manufacturing infrastructure after not having had it for so long gets more expensive every single year. So we have to be strategic about this. What would the best course of action be if we decided to do this as a nation for deciding exactly where to invest those dollars to bring back manufacturing?
First, if you don't mind, I'd like to define the problem of cost so people get an idea of what can happen.
Sure.
In 1970, we manufactured the bulk of displays around the world, television sets. I say displays because you see screens that allow you to look at pictures and whatever in all kinds of different forms, not just television sets. But in any case, at that point in time, it probably cost a couple of $1 million if you wanted to set up a manufacturing line to build television sets. In 1996, after most people had decided that consumer electronics in the United States was a lousy business because there was lots of competition, principally from Asia, the margins were terrible. It was not something where you could really dominate a particular area of activity and therefore increase your margins. And so we decided that we'll get out of those businesses, and that's how a lot of it went to Asia. The last television manufacturer was a company called Zenith, and Zenith was sold in 1996 to LG in Korea for approximately $360 million. Now, that sale was the sale of the entire company. That includes all its intellectual property, manufacturing facilities, everything. That was a company that had been in business for years and years and years. It had certain profitable sides to it, but fundamentally, the television business was a losing deal. They sold it off to LG for $360 million. Today, to build one manufacturing facility to manufacture flat-screen displays will cost you 10 times the price that they sold the entire company for 12 years ago, namely about $3.5, $3.6 billion. So you can see that the cost of being in these businesses, because the technology is advancing so fast, just goes up exponentially. On the other hand, the products that come out of those manufacturing facilities can do so many things that the markets for those products go up exponentially as well, and therefore the power, the economic power that accrues to the nation or the companies that are producing these products. So that gives you a sense of what we're talking about in terms of cost. In terms of strategy, I think that the first thing that any company does or has to do in order to promulgate its business, to be in business and have a reasonable relationship between itself, its customer base, and, by the way, its investors, is to convince its investors that the way that company is trying to be in business is the right way, the products are the right products, and the investors need to stick with the company over the long pull, whatever that, however they define that, over the long pull as they try to achieve their goal, the goal being a goal that is truly worth sticking with it. The problem has come about that there are many ways available to companies to increase the amount of profits in the short term and the cash flow in the short term that sometimes is at the expense of the long-term viability of the company. And a way of for that is very simple. If you look at the semiconductor industry, you can manufacture the semiconductor yourself in a plant that can cost as much as $6, $7 billion for a single plant, which is what is being built right now by Toshiba for their NAND flash. And or you can have somebody else do it for you that already has built a fabrication facility and would be happy to have your business. Most of those facilities are in Asia. So if you don't have to put up the money, you've just saved yourself $6 billion of that cash you can distribute in any way you want back to your investors, either by buying your stock back or dividends or whatever else. Similarly, if the company that's building the manufacturing facility will all manufacture your products for you, you don't have as much to worry about in terms of inventory, product production control, making sure that you meet specifications. That's their problem. And so your margins increase, your profits increase, and your cash flow increases. What's not to like? Well, what's not to like is if you find yourself in 10 or 20 years out of the business altogether, because those businesses tend to infect all the other businesses. They're all converging. And so you find out the loss of one begins to cause the loss of others. So it's very important that individual companies understand the nature of what is truly long-term, convince the investor that it's worth sticking with them, and then, of course, the management has to produce. At the same time, if the country as a whole is stimulated to want profits and honor profits now and cash flow now over what comes in the long term, then it becomes very, very difficult for the management of an individual company to try to convince its investors that somehow they should do it their way, that is the company's way, on one hand, while the country as a whole is going a different way on the other hand. Because of that, it requires that the United States of America as a country and the administration, namely the President of the United States and then Congress, create a cultural environment where people begin to recognize that the long pull is vitally important and long-term investments, even though in the short term it means a requirement for cash and less profits, is vitally important. If the country as a whole is not competitive, it becomes very, very difficult for individual companies within it to be competitive. Do you want me to stop there for a second?
Hang on. I have a follow-up question on a related note from Austin. He writes, if we move manufacturing back to the U.S., won't prices skyrocket, thus hurting the U.S. industry you're hoping to improve?
In other words, we can't manufacture it here as cheaply as they can do it someplace else.
I believe that's the question, yes.
And the answer is that if, in fact, we cannot make it as competitively here as we can make it someplace else, then we will finally lose. We will not only lose the industry, we'll lose our freedom, we'll lose our ability to compete, we'll lose our standard of living. This will not be a country that in any way, shape, or form is the country that people have been used to living in for low these many years. So the answer is we got to learn how to make it just as inexpensively. We have to learn how to make it in a way which, in fact, allows a product to be competitive with whatever is offered by any other country on the face of the earth. The way you do that is not just offer it in terms of price and cost. You offer it in terms of value. So what we have to be able to do is with our creativity at all levels of the production process, you have to come up with a product which has greater value for what you're selling it for than the other guy's product. So, for example, if you take a look at a Lexus or a Mercedes or whatever else, the prices of these products are substantially higher than other cars that sell against them. But in theory, what you're buying is quality. You're buying features and capabilities that the other products don't have. That's the way you compete.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Mike in Dallas. Hi, Mike.
Hello. Well, I'd like to offer a possible solution, run it by you, and see what you think. And first, I'd like to say you're absolutely right. I think it's the quality of the products that really are driving the sales. When we think Sony, Toyota, Honda, I mean, we think quality, and especially with American automakers, they have just been slacking so bad. But I'm going to offer a solution. It's very radical, but let me run it by you, and then I'll hang up and see what you think. I think the whole nation, business, government, people have to get a new mindset here in America. And I think as the people, when we clock in, I think we need to have a better mindset, care about our jobs, and care about a good job. And I think that companies are going to have to veer away from perks like paid vacations, health care, retirement, these things that are costing fortunes. And I think that they're just going to have to go to a system where people make a decent wage when they work. But, you know, if you take a week off, you don't get paid for that. Health care, the nation needs a national health care system where there's not hundreds of little pools, but one huge pool.
Mike,
and,
I think you made some
and
good...
Social Security for retirement. That's all.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your call.
Okay, thank you.
What do you think about that idea, Dick?
Well, in a strange way, I kind of agree. What I'm not trying to agree with is that we shouldn't have health care in one form or another or paid vacations, because lots of countries in Asia, for example, or Europe, where we compete, have, if anything, more benefits than we have. What I think we do have to have, and where I think the gentleman is absolutely correct, and that is we got to have a strategy. We have to have a mindset where people understand that however we plan to afford whatever we want, we have to figure out in a way that allows us to produce value added to our productive efforts such that we become an exporting nation as opposed to an importing nation. Let me be very specific about that. If you look at the number of consumers that are going to come out of India and China, just in terms of the numerical number of people that are involved, you're talking billions versus millions. Because of that, we are going to want to serve that market, those markets, because that's where the people are. And in fact, those markets are already producing products that we are going to want to produce that will be competitive in markets where the product and the market and the people producing it are all in the same place. So just as Japan did, we are going to have to figure out how we can add so much value that we become more desirable in many respects than products produced indigenously, for example, in China or in India or, for that matter, any place else in the world. To do that, we've got to have a mindset that concentrates on long-term benefits from long-term investments that create our own individual capability to add value that is more competitive than that exists existing any other place in the world.
What, if anything, Dick, is working in our favor right now if we decide as a nation to make this the way we go in the future?
There's a lot that's going in our favor. One of the things that is a problem in making investments virtually any place else certainly in the developing countries, emerging countries, is the fact that what you see in the United States, irrespective of whatever problems we've been going through, what you see is pretty much what you get. When you buy something, it's yours. When you sell something, it's theirs. When you design something, the intellectual property remains yours, and you have the ability to protect it. You have laws, you have stability, you have a political situation which allows for a reasonable level of predictability in terms of circumstances and how they're going to develop over time. It's the reason why most people in the world want to do business in the United States. What we have to do is to make it attractive enough for those other companies and countries to want to invest and build plants and research and development capabilities in the United States to help us re-educate ourselves in businesses where we have lost our position. At the same time, we want to use this as a platform and the creativity that exists here with a population that works just as hard as anybody else in this world, just as smart as anybody else in this world, to create their own industries with their own competitive advantages.
How does a weak dollar in the current market affect our ability to bring back manufacturing?
Well, that's a very complicated question.
I've given you 90 seconds to answer.
Okay. I'll try to give you a really simple answer. It's a double-edged sword. If your dollar drops too far, then your country doesn't have any credibility. To the extent you've got to buy anything, it's going to cost you a fortune. Okay, that is, buy anything that you don't make here, it's going to cost you a fortune. That's how you get stagflation. On the other hand, if the dollar gets too strong, it becomes very difficult to compete. Ultimately, the dollar tends to seek its own level, and is based more on the productive enterprise of the country than it is on the price of the dollar per se. I happen to be, contrary to a lot of people, against a very weak dollar. I mean, there's moderation in everything, but a really weak dollar, we don't want to go back to where we started. We're more advanced than that.
How optimistic are you that anyone in a position to change things is going to listen to what you have to say?
This subject that we're talking about today has been coming up for a long time. Just before Japan's real estate bubble burst in 1990, the United States was deathly afraid that they were going to lose their industrial base as it related to technology to the Japanese. And in fact, we weren't doing a very good job. But then the real estate bubble burst, and we figured that Japan was finished. It wasn't finished. It remained an export country all that time. We tend to be highly opportunistic, riding on the back of a country that had huge assets, both in intellectual property as well as technological expertise at the end of World War II.
The book by Richard J. Elkis is Winner Take All. Dick, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
I sure hope it was okay.
It was great. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.